The views and opinions expressed by host and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of the Global Liberty Alliance, its network, sponsors, donors, or broadcast platforms. The Global Liberty Alliance provides this podcast for informational purposes. Freedom of speech is a fundamental right and essential for free societies to prosper. Thank you for listening and supporting the mission of the Global Liberty Alliance, dedicated to strengthening and defending fundamental individual rights, free markets, and the rule of law.
Got it.
Okay. Let me just turn this up. All right. Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And welcome to another Global Liberty Alliance podcast. This is Jason Poblet coming to you yet again. We're still in Florida, folks. I'm not sure if we're going to head back to Virginia anytime soon, but we're happy here on the Space Coast coming to you on a sunny day. I know my friends up in Virginia and with the Global Liberty Alliance up there, they're a little cold for them. Today we have a great show. First, I want to thank our listeners. Thank you for keeping the ideas coming. Thank you again for your donations. We couldn't do this without you. And thank you to a special listener in Miami who does not want to be named for recommending today's guest. We have Special Agent Pete Lapp, who served for over 2 decades with the FBI. A highly experienced counterintelligence, espionage, economic espionage, and trade secret theft expert. We're looking forward to chatting with him because we're going to go over and unpack one of his more high-profile cases, the espionage investigation of Ana Belén-Montes, who I think Pete has dubbed the Queen of Cuba. He'll tell us in a minute if he did. She was sentenced to 25 years for spying, folks. A lot of you don't know about the case. We're going to include a lot of information in the further reading case notes. We're going to gloss over a lot of history here, but I'll just give you the big picture, and then we'll talk to Pete about the nuts and bolts of what happened. She spent 25 years spying. She was sentenced 25 years for spying for the Cuban Intelligence Service while she worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA. That's one of the several intelligence agencies of the U.S. government. On January 6th of this year, Montes was released. She was in the headlines and was let go. And in fact, what led me to Pete was I was kind of upset that this lady spent all this time in federal prison. And she made a statement to the press that to me seemed she was extremely unrepentant. At least I think she was. And I called a friend in Miami. She said, hey, you got to talk to Pete. Pete is currently, after spending all these years serving the government, serving the American people, making sure bad people did not steal our secrets and kept America safe, he's now consulting at PJ Lapp Consulting, where he focuses his background and experiences in counterintel and insider risk, helping companies navigate that minefield and, again, keeping America safe and keeping companies safe. Pete, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you having me on. One quick clarification. I'm retired. I'm no longer.
That's right. You're completely out. Retired. You're out there consulting and doing that separate from your time in government. Let's start there before we get into the case and all the work you've done. What drew you to the FBI? We have a lot of young listeners who hear a lot of things about the FBI today in the media that are not correct. Some of it may be true, but I don't believe it is. At least my experience with the FBI has always been good. What drew you to work in the FBI, and how did you end up working in counterintel?
It's a great question. I grew up in on the Jersey Shore in the mid to late 80s. And I honestly, when I was in high school, wanted to be a rock star. Okay. I wanted to be the next Bon Jovi. And I lacked a lot of talent and, frankly, dedication to practicing my craft of wanting to become a rock star. When I got to college, I really was kind of aimless. And my roommate, Joe Ashman, who's a dear friend to this day, I said, early on, what do you want to do with your life? And he's like, I want to be a Maryland state trooper. Mm. And I said, that sounds kind of cool. Like New Jersey, we both were from New Jersey, and New Jersey State Police have had this, very proud image and reputation. And I started thinking about law enforcement. my father lost his job early on and in my freshman year. And he said, you might want to think about ROTC. And I went and drifted towards enlisting in the Army National Guard and in ROTC. And in that time frame, the mantra was be all you can be. That was kind of their their marketing. And I knew that if I was going to go into law enforcement, I wanted to be all I could be. I wanted to go to what I felt at the time and what I continue to today believe is the greatest law enforcement agency in the world, which is the FBI. It's not perfect. You know, it's made up of human beings that all have flaws. It's not a perfect institution, but I believe today in my heart of hearts, it's still the greatest law enforcement agency in the world. And I'm just so proud to have been able to say I was an FBI agent. It really is, you know, one of the great honors of my, my life.
How did you go from, like, how did you end up in counterintel?
Kicking and dragging and a little bit of little bit of screaming and whining and crying thrown in for extra dramatic measure. You know, I started my law enforcement career as a police officer, a street cop in a town outside of Philadelphia. And I thought that when I went to the FBI, they would take my background in criminal justice, my 5 years as a street cop, and put me to work doing the cool stuff, working gangs and drugs and violent crimes and, you know, basically, you know, wrestling with bad guys, you know, in the street, but at the federal level. And I knew that Washington Field was close enough to Philly, where I was from. And I knew they would have a lot of people, you know, that they would have to staff. So I put Washington Field number one. And then, you know, the dartboard, the, you know, the FBI would like to joke about the monkeys are in the back room throwing darts. And that's how you get your assignment to your field office. And then even from there, what you get to assign to work. And I submitted my resume, if you will. I couldn't even find Cuba on a map. And I got a call from my boss halfway through Quantico saying, hey, congratulations, I'm your new boss. You're coming to work Cuban counterintelligence. And I literally said, what the hell is that? And and she said, I can't tell you over the phone. I said, well, wow, this is going to be really fun.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. And I, you know, well, honest, it's one of those lessons in life where, you know, regardless of what you want to work, sometimes getting put somewhere that you don't want to work can be life changing. And this was life changing for me professionally, going to work Cuban counterintelligence. So, you know, again, lucky break for me.
You know, like I said in the intro, we get a lot of young people listening to this show. What's your advice to them about a career in the FBI, if they want public service, if they want to pursue this? What's the one thing they should do to maybe take that step in that direction? I think we need more public servants. We need folks that do jump into the FBI. I think it's a great organization. What's your advice to them, given what they say in the news?
Yeah, it is a great organization. And obviously, I think over the past 6 years or so, it's had its share of bumps and bruises. I think it's a noble organization that if you're considering working for the federal government, it's still the premier law enforcement agency. I think that you have to recognize going into any agency of the U.S. government, even in local law enforcement, you've got to put your personal politics aside. And you really lose a certain First Amendment privilege of being able to vocalize your political beliefs, because we need to have the reputation of being apolitical. You know, whether you work for the FBI, the CIA, or the Coatesville Police Department, you've got to be seen as being apolitical. The public doesn't care about your political opinion. So I think that for new people going into and striving for that, recognize that you're going to lose a little bit of your First Amendment privileges because the public doesn't care about your politics. And therefore, you're there to do a job, uphold the Constitution and protect the American people. And regardless of whether, you know, your person that you voted for is in office or not. And I think that's probably become a lot more relevant and prevalent, you know, since, you know, towards the end of my career, and certainly over the past several years, that probably didn't wasn't so cognizant to me back in 1998 when I started.
So jump into the subject matter. And since we have a lot of lawyers that listen to us, Ana Belén Montes, when she was on her way to federal prison, said something that to this day sticks with me. And I was preparing to talk to you. It's the one thing I remember from her case when she either said in court or somewhere, "I obeyed my conscience rather than the law."
Yeah.
What does that tell you about her personality? And I'm going a little backwards. We'll tell people how you all got to her. But
right.
When she got out a few weeks ago, this lady sounded very unrepentant. And it's the same person, I think, I read that quote from, I don't know how many years ago it's been. What is it about her that she would say something like that? And what does it say about how she spent so much time in our government and nobody was able to find her?
She knew that she was committing a crime. There was no ambiguity in her mind about the legality. Without question, she knew she was committing espionage, and she knew it was a violation of federal law.
So all the way back there in 1984, when she went from DOJ clerk to DIA, you think that's, she moved into that position knowing I'm going to break the law?
Oh, absolutely. Wow. There, no question, 100%. Wow. And knew that she was committing a crime. Now, what she told us, you know, in the debriefings in the room one-on-one was, and by say us, I see, you know, myself and Steve McCoy, my partner, who, you know, forever indebted for our partnership and being partners with him. I mean, she told us that she knew she was committing a crime, but morally, she felt that she was doing the right thing. And in fact, she said she thought it would have been inhumane of her not to have helped the Cubans. So legal law and moral laws are often, you know, not maybe completely aligned in terms of what's more significant. But in her mind, her moral compass was that she was doing the right thing, even though she knew she was committing a criminal act in terms of espionage.
You know, back in, to give people a little memory, historical context, when she made that leap from DOJ clerk to DIA analyst in the world of U.S.-Cuba policy, it was a time of a lot of transition. It was, some would say, the height of the Cold War, or the beginning of the height of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War. And, you know, Radio Martí, a U.S. government radio station, I think, was started in 83. Reagan had started to push a more aggressive policy toward Cuba, even though there were some other changes with our policy in other parts of the world. But as far as Cuba went, it was an interesting time. Also in Central America, you had the Contras, you had battles in other countries. When she went into this space, it was not just Cuba, right? I mean, she also had these almost a Puerto Rican nationalist mindset and kind of a radical mindset. That did she bring that to this, to the table? Was Cuba just her only concern when she was doing what she did since the beginning of the Cold War, since the beginning of that period that she made that transition from DOJ to DIA?
Well, a couple points. I think it's important to recognize, and I think it's been overlooked, perhaps underemphasized. So she began at DIA in September of 1985. And she walked in the door fully recruited. You know, she went there for the purpose of spying for the Cubans. But from 1985 until 1992, her day-to-day need to know had nothing to do with Cuba. She was assigned to work El Salvador and Nicaragua, which for the U.S. intelligence community was a higher priority, given what we were doing, under President Reagan. In that, you know, very controversial, Iran-Contra type era, if you will, foreign policy. So it's important to recognize that she was spying for Cuba for the first 7 years, but really not having any day-to-day information about Cuba. And having all that she saw every day was El Salvador, Nicaragua, depending on when she was assigned to those accounts. I think that a lot of folks tend to politicize this case because it's Cuba, it's ideology, it's, you know, she didn't receive money. Her motivation was because of in addition to being very anti-American, I think she was vehemently opposed to Reagan's policies, and especially with regards to Latin America, in with Iran-Contra and all that went on. It's not a political discussion. It's a policy discussion because, you know, she started spying because of Reagan's policy, someone who she clearly didn't support politically. But then when Bill Clinton comes into office in 1992, she arguably did some of her most damaging espionage during the Clinton administration, you know, for the next 8 years. So it's not a political conversation. It's a policy conversation because, you know, Clinton didn't change policy with regards to Cuba in relationship to the embargo, which she kind of alludes to in her post-incarceration statement that she made about two weeks ago after being released and heading to Puerto Rico. So I think it's kind of important to focus on the policy versus the politics, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, if Reagan wasn't elected president, would Ana Montes have committed espionage? It's a good question. I mean, it's a hypothetical, but who knows? But definitely the moons were aligned in 1984 when she was spotted and assessed and then volunteered.
That's fascinating. We're going to come back to that in a second. Before we jump deeper into her case and how you all started, whatever you can share with us, of course, of how you all started to hunt her down, who is, for people who haven't followed this, who is Marta Rita Velasquez? And what's her role in all of this? Because there's an indictment out there from 2004. And was she her handler? Was she somebody who helped facilitate the contact with the Cubans?
Marta was more of a so Marta was, by the time she met Ana at Johns Hopkins, SAIS, School of Advanced International Studies in D.C., they both were graduate students in 1983, 1984. They had a lot in common, obviously both women and both Puerto Rican by descent. So they immediately connected just based on that. I mean, you know, the women to men ratio in graduate school, even in D.C. at that time, was probably heavily skewed to men. Mm-hmm. Marta already had clearly a relationship with the Cuban intelligence service. You know, I believe that she was already fully recruited. And then when she's in, but at that time she wasn't in access. Like, so I think she worked at the Department of Transportation as an attorney.
Yeah.
So really not doesn't have access to classified information. So, you know, on the books for the Cubans, you know, got a relationship, probably have a source number for her and have conversations with her, but she's not passing classified information at that time, to my knowledge. She's kind of laying out there and spots and assesses Ana and says, wow, this woman is bright, has a clearance, works at DOJ and hates, you know, our policy in Latin America, and befriends her. And then after spending time with her and importantly, spending time with her family, you know, Marta got to know her family and Ana's family got to know Marta. I mean, I have pictures of all of them together, which is it's sad and kind of shocking, to be honest with you, because as she's really assessing Ana's, you know, reliability as a potential future Cuban spy, she's integrating herself as a friend to the family. And Marta finally, you know, at some point in time says, you know, I have a friend who wants to meet you. He's a Cuban diplomat, works up in New York, and he wants to have dinner. Now, this should have been a clue and a flag, because Ana had a clearance. And, you know, with a clearance, you're not supposed to have contact with foreign diplomats. If you do, you're supposed to tell your employer, your security office. This should have been a flag. But Ana, you know, her mindset is, you know, where and when? Sure, let's do it. And, you know, completely ambivalent to the implications to her clearance and you know what DOJ would have done had they found out. So she willingly took the train up with Marta to have dinner with this Cuban diplomat, who I will be naming in the book, hopefully, as long as it gets through the pre-publication review. And the dinner is a very nice dinner. You know, this diplomat offered her to do kind of a moonlighting project that didn't have anything to do with espionage, but definitely was a test question. It was, you know, if you're willing to do this, then maybe down the road, a couple months later, we'll ask you to commit espionage. And Anna and Marta take the train home, and Anna told us that she had an epiphany. And she said this little gig, which would have been a problem for her at DOJ, she would not have been allowed to do this moonlighting gig for the Cubans. She decided that this gig wasn't going to really help the Cubans. And she said to herself, and I'm assuming she had a conversation with Marta on the train, Anna said, you know, if I'm really going to help the Cubans, I need to get a job working in the intelligence community. And essentially volunteered in that moment to work for the Cubans. And the course of her life just changed on that, in that night. I mean, you know,
that's amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, she was going to go finish her degree. I mean, the DOJ job was just a job to get through graduate school, and, you know, was not her life's ambition, not a high level position at all. She was going to go work for Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, you know, doing good for the world in one of these NGOs. And then Marta introduces her to the Cubans, and her life changed dramatically in that moment, and decided to go work in the intelligence community.
This, we'll leave Martha not at the side, but I think Martha also spent time at USAID as well. And in Guatemala of all places. I mean, that's a subject matter for a whole different podcast, Guatemala. But so back to her now, and to Ana Belén Montes now, and your involvement. How, you know, I've heard a lot of stories about how they caught her, how they didn't catch her. A lot of people have read a lot of stuff about her. In fact, these news stories that have come out since she was released, it's as if some of us are reliving a phase of things that happened. You know, for folks who don't know much about this case, again, we're going to provide a lot of program notes, a lot of summaries. Go ahead and read them. So, because that's been published, but since Pete's with us and he was involved in the key people involved in catching her, I think we want to focus on that for a minute. And of course, your book is out, by the way. I think it's like in October. That's when your book may be out. You can pre-order it now.
Correct. The target is October 10th, I believe, but you can pre-order now wherever you buy your books from.
Yeah, we've done that. I'm ready. I want to read another one.
I'm ready for this to be done and out and sharing with the world. So trust me,
That's good stuff.
Excited too.
So she was nabbed, I believe, a few days after 9/11 terrorist attacks, 2001.
Yes.
And of course, we're skipping over a lot, folks, but since we don't have Pete here for a whole long time, I want to get the highlights from him. Before we get to that, a few things that happened from a policy perspective that I think folks should hone in on. In 1992, there was a big shift in policy. Not big, but it was a change. The first time I think the embargo had been stabbed a little in 1992 was the passing of the Cuban Democracy Act. So there was this process where telecommunications between Cuba and the United States were improved, supposedly, in exchange for, you know, Castro and his people allowed us to do certain things, reconnect cables, communicate with Cuba as long as we paid them money from the fees generated from those calls. Then in 1996, there was another big law, Helms-Burton law, that was changed. That happened as a result of the Brothers to the Rescue shoot down, which Pete's going to tell us, I guess, a little bit about in a minute. And then in 2000, there was the Trade Sanction Reform Act, which was a big change also in certain, not just Cuba, certain sanction laws. Sandwich in between that, the Cuban Five get arrested in 1998. And then, of course, Elian Gonzalez, how can we forget the Elian Gonzalez case in 99. 9/11 happens, though, and a few days after the terrorist attacks down the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon and the other attacks, we learned about Ana Belén Montes, and we figured, you know, my wife and I and some other people who had heard about her over the years in our time in Washington, some were not surprised. Frankly, I had never really heard that much about her because I had no reason to get involved in that space. But tell the folks who don't know about this, what led to that moment in her, you know, about her arrest and what's true and what's not true about what has been reported about it?
Big question there.
I threw a lot there, but what the
heck? No, it's good. It's good. So we the intelligence community, and I have to be careful because I'm working through pre-pub, you know, there's a lot that I believe I can reveal. However, there's things I want to keep for the book and also make sure that I think it's good practice to stay on the good side of the government. I don't know. I'm just gonna throw that out there. It's probably,
you know, we have laws to obey, right? And regulations.
Let's stay
to
on the good side of the FBI. Why not?
That's right.
It's been kind of my underlying mantra here as I write. We knew over the years, we knew that the Cubans had penetrated the US government and the US intelligence community. And finally, there's a breakthrough, critical breakthrough in 1994, where we get very specific information. This kicks off an unsub investigation, unknown subject. And by one, I mean, there are dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of these cases that are opened, one of which ultimately becomes Ana Montes. Hmm. Because of some breakthroughs, some counterintelligence successes, and you mentioned the Miami Five, we referred to it as the Royal Flush investigation, and I think it's the Loretta Vispa case.
Yep.
We had successes there that enriched what we knew about this unsub that became Ana Montes. I think the challenge, you know, one of the things you asked about what's been out there and maybe what's not accurate information. I think it's important to put this mole hunt into context, because there's been a lot of criticism from many people, even some folks inside government that were close to the case that, you know, have discussed how easy it was. Well, you know, here's the deal. Based on this information from 1994, we had an initial suspect population of 2.5 million people, not including contractors. We weren't even considering contractors that worked for three very large agencies of the U.S. intelligence community and the U.S. government. 2.5 million people. That's a lot of suspects. Now, when you take that and you start to narrow that down in terms of other 2.5 million, who would live, you know, somewhere between North Carolina and New England, where these high frequency messages were receivable, you could take that 2.5 million and narrow that down pretty significantly. But let's say we narrow down to about a million.
Hmm.
That's a heck of a lot of suspects. And therefore, it takes time. And I think another really important caveat to this, the information that we get in 1994 is very sensitive, but some of the breakthroughs that we had, the counterintelligence successes that we had, were classified top secret. Hmm. And sharing that top secret information that didn't belong to the FBI, frankly, sharing that with folks that could potentially know the tidbits, as I call them, of what we should be looking for to help us identify were incredibly difficult. You know, we couldn't just, you know, put out an all point bulletin to the entire federal government and say, hi, we're looking for certain information. If you have information, please contact your local FBI field office and send this out to 4 million federal employees, because you would be telling your suspect what you're looking for. So moving methodically, carefully, discreetly, to try to identify and narrow down that, let's just call it a million people, down to something that's manageable, it took a lot of time and it took a lucky break. And I've said it on record, the FBI got very lucky when a certain analyst at a certain agency that I'm not even sure I can name yet, talked to people at DIA about the tidbits, and the right people at DIA finally heard the tidbits and said, we think that's Ana Montes. And the DIA deserve tremendous credit for their role in identifying Ana Montes as a prime suspect of this unsub case that the FBI and others had been looking for by that point in time, nearly 6 years.
Well, what do you say to folks, though, that ask you, or ask anyone involved with this case, how did she spend 15 years in there doing this? I mean, supposedly she was briefing the Joint Chiefs. She was briefing the Security Council, got involved in some pretty sensitive operations in Latin America where people may have died. Yeah. People could have died. We don't know. In fact, we had an exchange recently on some commentary on LinkedIn recently where the people were posting about Montes. And one of the things we were asking about, you know, why didn't this lady get more of a life term or worse? Why do you think it took that long, maybe? And maybe there's no right answer. I mean, there is no answer. I think it's just like maybe you said, we got lucky and sometimes these people are that good. And why do you think she received the sentence she received? Because there's been some criticism lately that maybe she got off easy.
So let's break that into two parts here. Why was she able to do this for 17 years? She was near perfect. If I'm being honest, you know, memorizing every day the three most important things that she thought the Cubans needed to know from a security perspective is impossible to detect. You know, DIA security could have searched her purse every day and not found a spy camera, not found a floppy disk, not found a thumb drive, not found a document, a classified document. It was all in her head. There's no way of stopping that from a security counterintelligence perspective. Anytime that she came up on DIA's radar from a security perspective, and there were times when there were blips and inconsistencies with what she told, pre-employment about her background. There was obviously the Brothers to the Rescue incident and an event and her interaction with DIA and Scott Carmichael. Anytime that she came up on the radar, DIA, to their credit, had to balance these concerns, and I say that, and it's probably a little too strong, with her reputation and her distinguished reputation. I mean, I did not invent the label Queen of Cuba. That was her reputation within the intelligence community. And some people, you know, use it, you know, complimentary, and some people, you know, don't. It's kind of more derisive, as I've heard it say. But you're balancing, you know, this Brothers to the Rescue event and how she reacted with the reputation that she had and the accomplishments and how, and a lot of other things, you know. I mean, so you have to look at it in context and really be sure that you have a security issue with a person like Ana Montes, who's so well regarded, not well liked. I'll be frank. I mean, she was not someone who people enjoyed working with for the most part, in large part because of her intellectual stubbornness. A phrase that I'll steal from Ben McIntyre, who's a brilliant nonfiction author in this space, but intellectually arrogant, so not fun to work with, but someone who was very well regarded in terms of her analytical judgment for the most part. And I think then you're adding to that perfection, because the better she did her job, the more doors it opened, the more meetings that she would be invited to, the more she would be involved. So she really strived, in addition to being a very smart woman and a very talented analyst by many, not all agree with me, but by many. I mean, this is a smart, smart woman who did a very competent job at her job. But what it did was it helped open doors for her for her night job of, providing the Cubans with as much as she could memorize, you know, 5 days a week.
You know, what's fascinating about that also is that, and I guess I can't say I respect her, because I don't know.
Right.
You have to respect someone, though, who can keep all, not just keep the information in your mind, be able to deliver it, know what to pick out, but also to keep her other life in front of all these other people, the consumers of this information on this side, you know, the Americans, convinced that somehow she was and maybe she is very good at what she does, and she can analyze and provide you this information that policymakers need to make important decisions, and then go back and live this completely separate life and just not be caught in more than a decade. And that's, I guess you got to respect that from, I guess, a tactical standpoint. It's kind of like the worst. I don't know if in your world there's a word for it, but I guess that's probably be the worst type of spy you want to try and catch, because they're almost impossible to catch.
I think so. And I, you know, your word, you're struggling with the word respect, and I understand where you're at. You know, I've struggled with this myself. I don't admire what she did. I despise it. I used to hate her, but I now hate the sin. I don't hate the sinner.
Mm.
I do professionally respect how good she was as a spy and how she was near perfect in terms of how she conducted herself that allowed her to do it for so long, for 17 years almost. So I do have that. I do have a professional respect, kind of like, you know, I have a professional respect for the Cuban intelligence service. I mean,
that was my next question. Are they really as good as people say they are?
I think they're better. I think they're better, to be honest with you. And you know, I'll caveat this that I have my own bias, although I have worked China and I've worked Russia, not to the degree I did with Cuba. You know, looking at it from the U.S. government's perspective, and more the intelligence community, whether it's the FBI or other agencies, it's China, Russia, China, Russia, China, Russia, China, Russia. Hmm. Cuba always gets short shrift when it comes to resources and respect, and perhaps even, you know, not admiration, but just in terms of like, oh, they're a big deal, because it's not China, it's not Russia. And I think Cuba is pound for pound one of the best intelligence agencies in the world because of their ability to find folks like Ana Montes, like Marta Velasquez, like Kendall Myers, who all three, you know, unlike Hansen and Ames, who are kind of sleazes because they're doing it for money, they don't really admire or respect Russia. They did it because they just wanted money and other you know, human flaws that they had. Montes, Velasquez, and Kendall Myers, you know, they had this visceral empathy for Cuba and what it's trying to do, and that makes them incredibly dangerous as an intelligence service, because they don't pay for their sources. For the most part, they find these like-minded people that believe in a cause. And I don't think it gets much more dangerous than that. I mean, as a you know, I recruited human sources somewhat over the years, and I wouldn't say I was prolific at it. I was decent at it. I definitely, there were times where I would pay folks, and that was just, it was a transaction, and that was part of what their motivation was. But I always looked for that patriotism and that greater cause, and as a okay, I can trust this person because they believe in what we're trying to do from a national security perspective. It's that same kind of mindset that the Cubans took advantage of and exploited. And I think that's why they're one of the best, you know, frankly, but underrated, because small island, you know, it's not China, Russia, China, Russia.
You mentioned, I hadn't heard that case in a while.
Kendall Myers?
But this ties up with the Benin. Yeah, I hadn't heard that name in a long time. That he has a life sentence. So how did he get life in prison? And tell folks who may not be familiar with Kendall Myers who he was, but how did he get life in prison? And then Montes gets what I thought was a weaker sentence, I guess.
Yeah, great question. I appreciate you asking, because there's been a lot of misconception out there. It is. I understand. You know, there's probably, I wouldn't say a handful, but there's about two or three football teams worth of people that wish she would have spent the rest of her life in jail. who worked the case, who were involved in the case. And I may not be the starting quarterback, but I'm definitely, I'm first string somewhere on that team. I played a role in the 25-year sentence, the number, the evidence, And trust me, when January 6th came around and she was getting out, I had a really hard time that week with the fact that she was free. you go to prosecution with the case that you have,
right?
Not necessarily the case that you want. We had a very strong criminal case. 90% came from the laptop computer that was in her bedroom that I led the team to do the covert black bag job where we made the image. The reason she's in jail was because of that computer. Mm. And 90% of the arrest warrant was on that computer. We didn't get a lot of information after she was arrested that enriched our case. So what we had was, from a sentencing perspective and negotiating for a plea agreement, we had the laptop. This is what we could prove that she passed to the Cubans. So that's where you start in terms of evidence. I've heard, you know, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that proved that she led to the, you know, her intelligence led to the death of a Green Beret. And I believe that's probably the case. I believe she did identify him to the Cubans. We couldn't prove that in court. And there's a big difference. When you're talking about life and death, you've got to go to court with real evidence, not circumstantial evidence, I mean, because we're talking about death. A lot of other factors go into play. Venue.
Right.
You know, this case, Robert Hansen was convicted and he pled guilty and was a death penalty case, and it was in the Eastern District of Virginia.
Right.
It's definitely an aggressive prosecutive office. Montez was in the District of Columbia. So if in a trial, she would have been, the jury would have been, you know, her peers living within the District of Columbia. And it's a legitimate question as to whether a jury of her peers in D.C. would have sentenced her to death, a woman, for espionage, even after 9/11. So, and this is the kind of one of the biggest points I think that I need to make. The most sensitive information that I found, and I take credit for this because I found it on her computer, the most sensitive, damaging information, the Justice Department was not allowed to use it because the agency that owned it had it classified, and it was a special access program, a compartmented program. And they specifically told the Justice Department, and I do not criticize them in this. They have their own judgment to make in terms of disclosure of what this thing was, but we couldn't use it towards prosecution. So it's almost as though it didn't exist, frankly. I mean, because, you know, with Hansen, you know, we were moving forward for the death penalty because he identified three Russians that the U.S. intelligence community had recruited that were identified by him, investigated, and executed. So he had blood on his hands. Hmm. And here's the key distinction. The government was willing to testify to that. So they were going to court for a death penalty count and then negotiated a life sentence. The worst we would get, that she would get at trial in D.C., if we went to trial, was a life sentence. So you're negotiating from life down to what becomes reasonable. And for a 45-year-old woman, we mutually agreed. The government and her agreed to a 25-year sentence. A lot of the predicate information that started the investigation was top secret. So we risked, by not taking a plea, exposing that and having to declassify that, or making judgments as to not I know we're getting legalese here, but
that's okay. It's important.
Very it's kind of complicated. And trust me, you know, I wish 25 years was actually 30, 35, 40 or life. Mm. I frankly, you know, knowing what I know now, but not what I could have proved then, or we could have proved then, you know, I do think that a life in prison sentence would have been justified. However, you know, when we go to trial, you could lose and you could have to expose really classified information. And therefore, a plea is the best case. And then there's the debriefing, learning what she did, learning what she exposed, learning what she compromised, learning how she did. You know, we go to trial, we never hear the name Marta Velazquez. So the trade-off of what we learn from the debriefings is significant in and of itself. as part of the calculation of where you come up with, you know, a number like 25.
Well, and this is one of the reasons we wanted to have you and talk with you on the podcast, because there's been a lot said the last 3 weeks that if you're not a lawyer, if you're not in law enforcement, if you haven't spent any time in Washington doing policy work, if you start looking at these things in just one perspective and you don't factor in all those things that you were just talking about, you kind of, you know, this is not it's not McDonald's for law enforcement folks. I mean, there's a certain process you have to follow, certain procedures that have to be followed. And we do follow a higher standard. I do still believe America has the gold standard when it comes to law enforcement, and we have the gold standard when it comes to our legal system. It may not be perfect, but it works because we don't act the way the bad guys and bad girls do. So, and by the way, go ahead.
Great point. And again, it's, you know, I've said this before, knowing something and proving something
very different,
two vastly different things. And what we could prove was strong enough for a 25-year plea agreement. What we knew was far more, but we couldn't prove it. And it is what it is. You know, it's unfortunate, but you know, this is how this case broke.
Well, we've been talking with Pete Lapp over 2 decades in the FBI, talking about, he's retired now. We were talking about the Anabel Montes case and Cuba policy. As we start to get to the end of the program, I'm going to ask you a few questions about policy in a minute. But what do you, let me ask you something now about Congress, and just, this is brief, doesn't have, we're not going to spend too much time on this, but one of the documents I shared with a friend who recommended that we do this program was an Inspector General report that was done by DOD, because there was a lot of people in Congress who were very upset about how the Montes matter was handled. Do you think those criticisms back then were, and there was an Inspector General report done by DOD, and there were a few of them, a few papers that were done. Some are still classified, some are not. Some have been partially declassified. Some maybe will never be declassified, at least not in our lifetime. Do you think that the criticism from Congress at the time was warranted, or do you feel that they were just doing their job and pushing the agencies to kind of come clean on what happened and what didn't happen? Because let's face it, a lot of folks, I mean, do you think, let's come at the question another way. Because of the Cuba programs, because of, you know, the state sponsor of terrorism designations, policy generally, what she did during the time that she was there, let's say starting in 92 when she got more involved with Cuba, do you think that it would damage our policy? And do you think the policymakers were right to get upset the way they got upset with the FBI and everybody else?
I've said this before. I think her arrest was a success. It's a counterintelligence success. Her espionage was a counterintelligence failure. Hmm. And a lot of folks, you know, a lot of the same people that deserve credit for her arrest also share blame for the 17 years of committing espionage. These cases are always failures. Mugshots are great, but you know, the goal would be to get left of theft and try to prevent this from happening from day one. So I think, you know, Congress and people have a right to be asking probing critical questions about how something like this could happen for so long. I don't disagree with that. Did she affect policy, you know, on a macro scale? I'm not a firm believer in that she's, you know, she was the queen of Cuba, but I think we over embellish her influence too much. You know, I think that she probably nudged here and there, and there were things that she was able to get shot down. I've recently learned about a project that a young analyst under her at the time was moving forward and wanted to publish, and she was able to quash it. But this wasn't policy. This was more intelligence analytical product. And therefore, she had influence that way. I think, the DOD IG report, it's hard to read because so much of it is redacted. It's got the U.S. government's black highlighter that it uses from time to time, and I steal that from The Onion. That's the Onion joke.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, it's, you know, I understand. I think that our greatest assets that we have, whether we're, you know, a department, an agency, or a company, our greatest assets are our employees.
Yeah.
And our greatest vulnerabilities are our employees, because they're human beings who are subject to all sorts of influences over the course of their lives and careers. And therefore, you know, even Jesus had to worry about an insider. And
yeah, he did.
If he had to worry about an insider, I mean, you know, we this is a phenomenon. It's not going away, and it's going to continue until we figure out how to fix human flaws that prevent it. And that's just that unicorn's not walking in the door.
No. I just don't know how you can catch someone that has a photographic memory and is able to cover the tracks as good as she did. That part alone is, as somebody has to deal with words and cases, that's what we do for a living. And I don't have a photographic memory, folks. So you can't, I respect people who can do that. I know people who can do it, but from the type of, you know, the work that you all were doing, I just don't know how you do it unless they make a mistake. And obviously she did, because the system, I think the system worked. I don't believe the system failed. I think that eventually good people were in there doing their job and they noticed some patterns and they noticed it. To me, it wasn't a failure. I think, maybe she spent all that time in there. Okay, she did. But guess what? The system worked when it had to work. There were some good people, some patriots who were in there looking, saying, hey, something's not right here. And they just followed the clues until they figured out, hey, here we are. And she finally made a mistake or two and she got caught. So I think that's a lot of lessons here, but I think sometimes, like, I agree with you, they exaggerate what she may or may not have been able to influence, because ultimately the policymaker receives the information. Doesn't mean they have to accept all of it or any of it. You know, it's you. I know people who were briefed by her who pretty much ignored just about everything she said. So
let's be honest. I probably could call the book the GS-14 Queen of Cuba, or Queen parentheses GS-14. Like, yeah, you know, let's be honest. She wasn't Secretary of
That's
Cuba.
Right. That's it's right. Like, That's
you
right.
Know, let's be honest. She was a pretty senior, but you know, she didn't really work her way up too far. She was still an SES. You know, wasn't an executive. You know, so let's put her reputation in a little bit of context here.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of this is just, I tell the folks in Miami, friends of mine who, again, the fellow who asked me about, wanted me to talk to you. I just said, look, guys, she wasn't, you know, she may have been good at what she did, which was a very evil thing that she did. No fan, but they caught her, and it may have, may boggle the mind as to why. We may never know why. The point is they caught her, and a lot of lessons were extracted. I'm sure the community's out there figuring out ways to catch people, do stuff like that. So we got to move on, and she's the past, and we got to focus on the future. Talking a little bit about the future, how does this case impact the type of work you used to do? I mean, do they study it? Is it something that, I mean, I'm assuming all these cases are studied, but how does it impact that craft that you were in? And do you think that there'll be more people like this that will someday be caught or not caught?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I've been fortunate to talk about this case for the past 20 years inside government and now outside. I mean, to a degree, this is part of how I make my living with my consulting, is going out and talking about her and trying to emphasize different things about insider risk for a variety of different clients. So I think that, you know, one of the takeaways that I learned in my research for the book, I talked to several former Cuban intelligence officers who defected. And that part of the story, I'm really excited to share. One of the things I learned was that there were a lot of people outside of the folks in the Cuban intelligence service who knew Montes's true name. And it shocked me. It wasn't just like the handlers. It wasn't just the people in Havana who oversaw her, who obviously would have had a need to know who she was. There was a lot of other folks. And my message to people, anyone who may be listening, who is cooperating with the Cuban intelligence service, good luck with that. because, you know, if one of those folks, you know, has your name and decides they've reached their breaking point and comes out and says, you know, you're looking for this person's name. I was shocked with how many people outside of the need to know, as I would see it, knew the true identity of her. Now, obviously it was after the fact and too late to make an impact and make that 17 years, you know, maybe 12 or 13, but you know, anyone who's thinking about, you know, copycatting or following, admiring her footsteps, you know, again, good luck with that, because there's going to be a lot of people that know your real name who may decide to defect at some point in time and provide us with your name. I think that we have to, you know, take the lessons from this, learn as much as we can. You know, obviously she was, in my opinion, near perfect. But there were things that did happen that could have, and make sure that we message this, see something, say something, and have mm-hmm. no regrets. You know, there were instances that I'll be talking about where, you know, towards the end of her anonymity to the FBI, she was starting to come up on people's radar. And there was another track of identification that has yet to be, has not been reported. And I'm excited to share this in the book, in large part because of some of her blocking of a particular intelligence product that someone wanted to write. So that see something, say something, and have no regrets, that still works. You know, we've gotten, you know, very good with technology and insider threat technology and looking at the whole person. But at the end of the day, the managers, the coworkers, they still, you know, are some of the best sources of information of perhaps concerns, you know, and having that confidence to report to the right people. Hey, she said something or he said something in this meeting, and I just, it struck me as odd. And I think you should know. That information flow should continue. And I do think that's probably one of the takeaways for me of Montez to, you know, potential clients or anyone, you know, in the government or even in companies, because it's a viable source of information, regardless of how good we've gotten with insider threat technology.
Well, I have one last question.
Far better than we were back when she was, you know, 20 years ago. It's the technology is greatly improved.
Do you think stuff like AI will help in this sort of thing, or is it still too soon to know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, you know, with looking at Montez as a model, everything she provided the Cubans, she had the need to know. So, you know, 17 years, she didn't go looking for Russia stuff. She didn't go look for China stuff. She wasn't, you know, kind of snooping around on people's desks. Everything she gave the Cubans, she had a legitimate need to know. So that in and of itself would not have been a flag to security folks, because no one would have said, hey, she's snooping around on this. I mean, and again, that goes back to her reputation. The harder she worked, the better she was acclaimed and recognized, the more meetings and teams and groups and conversations she became involved with. So the need to know becomes, you know, a guiding principle in this story. And it works both in our favor and against us.
So this is the last question for you. And this is very inside the Beltway, folks. So I just want to warn you. But I hear a lot from policymakers that they complain. This is not this public stuff of too much compartmentalization and everything gets stovepipe. They like to throw that term around. I don't know if because they want to generate headlines. But does a case like this one speak more in favor or against stovepiping and compartmentalizing as much as they do in the intelligence community?
That is a great, great question. I just read an article today on CNN with, you know, the handling of classified information and mishandling. You know, it's obviously in the news lately with former President Trump and now President Biden. And that debate about whether, you know, do we overclassify information? You know, how do we share it? And is there implications in that need to know because we're not sharing, you know, classified information with the right people? I have a mixed opinion on this. I can argue it both ways. There's a story that I'm going to tell in the book that has never been told. and Montez, but not for an incredibly lucky break, was really close to hearing some of the most sensitive tidbits that we were looking for.
Hmm.
And therefore, you know, when you think about, okay, we've got a Cuban spy, we've got all this information, you know, we were really close, and I'll say the collective we, but it wasn't really a we were really close to alerting her about information. And this was after the arrest in Miami, where her anxiety was already at an elevated state because of the arrests of Loretta Vispa in September 1998. So I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, if we could have shared that information more broadly, would we have identified Montez earlier? Probably. Would it have alerted Montez? Probably. And I have an anecdote story that I think highlights that dual edge. How do you discreetly take, you know, 2.5 million people, potential suspects, and whittle that down to a handful that's manageable? There's an art and not a science to it. And we get lucky better, more than we're good, to be honest with you. And in this case, we got incredibly lucky all the way around.
I think the country owes
hard work was done. But we got lucky. We got lucky.
Well, I think the country, though, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. By the way, folks, it's called Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. We're going to provide links to that. But I think the country owes that whole team, all of you, a huge, you know, high five for getting. I don't believe in luck, but OK, we'll call it luck. But I think it's important that she got caught and that some group of people were on her scent, that they did the right thing, and they were dogged about it. Having spent time in the government and 3 decades working in Washington, D.C., that's not an easy task, I'm telling you. I wasn't in the government as long as you guys were in the government, but I spent enough time in there to know to make things happen in a government as big and complex as this one, especially in the space you all were in. The fact that she got caught, I think, is almost a miracle, considering political miracle, considering how this lady just would pretty much put everything in her head, walk away, and you'd never know. You had no idea. And I'm looking forward to reading the book. We've been talking to Pete Lapp. Pete, thank you for joining us. Do you have any words of wisdom for the next generation of FBI agents, even though you gave some tips at the beginning, but anything you want to share with the future crowd that's coming in?
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate you recognizing the team, because this is not a me case. This is a we case. A lot of folks deserve a bow from a variety of different agencies, you know, DIA, others yet to be named by me, and the FBI. And, you know, Montez is not in jail without DIA, and Montez is not in jail without the FBI. So thank you for, we appreciate your comments and gratitude. Thank you.
Will you come back when you have the book published?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, absolutely. Good. I love doing podcasts. I think they're so much fun. I mean, it's just two people having a conversation that, you know, 50,000 people are eavesdropping on, you know, however many people. I think it's cool. I think it's
with great. No interruption. Yeah, people listen, no interruption. But, you know, believe it or not, we started this thing a few years ago, and then we'll say goodbye to everyone. But we did this as just because we had folks that want to hear more about the work we were doing. And when you go on TV to talk about cases, you know, they're editing stuff out. And we went from like 2 or 3 countries. Now we're heard of about 80 countries or maybe more now. And we got calls from people all over the world just asking us to do more shows. And we don't do it, frankly, because I don't have as much time as I should. I should do more of these, they tell me. But yeah, we enjoy it. It's a way to kind of let people think through problems and think through ideas and send us ideas and talk through things that you just can't get on broadcast news. So I think it's a useful information tool for some of the work that we do.
Well, for your audience, if there's any follow-up questions, I'm happy to answer them. You know, hit me up on petelapp.com.
Right.
And my email address is on there, and I'm happy to, you know, further a conversation with anyone who wants to talk about this.
Well, thanks again, Pete. Have a great rest of the weekend.
Thank you, sir. You too.
All right.